Hello, everyone. My name is Jen Malotz, and I'm happy to welcome you to the first podcast in our new Freshfields Antitrust podcast series, Essential Antitrust. This podcast series is going to replace our longstanding webinar series, but we'll still be bringing you the same global antitrust insights on a frequent basis and covering hopefully an even broader range of topics. All of this is going to come to you in an on-demand format that lets you listen to the podcast wherever and whenever works for you. Now, if you're already on our mailing list, you'll get an email whenever a new podcast is available with a link that lets you listen on the web from your desktop, your phone, your tablet, or any connected device. The podcast is also available on all of your favorite podcast apps, so you can listen and subscribe by searching for the Freshfields podcast. So it's a new year, a new decade, and we have a new podcast. So what better topic to start out with than our 10th annual 10 Key Themes publication, which was released just last week. And I'm happy today to be joined by Thomas Janssens, who's the head of our Global Antitrust Competition and Trade Practice Group here in Brussels, and by Sarah Jensen, who's a counsel in our antitrust practice in London, and who's one of the driving forces behind our 2020 report. So, Thomas, this is our 10th edition of 10 Key Themes. And for anyone listening who isn't familiar with the publication, what is 10 Key Themes and why did we start this project?
10 Key Themes, Jen, is our annual review of the antitrust landscape. Every year what we do is we work with colleagues from across our entire firm and we try to predict the key trends in antitrust and beyond that our clients should be looking out for over the next year, and the steps they should be taking now to be prepared. If you haven't received your copy, there's a link with the invitation to this podcast, or you can, of course, also find it on the Freshfields website.
So, Sarah, if we look at our publication this year and the antitrust landscape today, what, for you, are the standout themes that we expect to see in 2020?
If we look across all the key themes that we've identified, I think there are three overarching trends that will impact antitrust enforcement across the piece in 2020. I think first, and perhaps the most obvious one, is digital transformation, particularly the role that personal data is playing in the way companies compete to sell their products and services. As you know, we saw a range of different proposals for new laws and regulations coming out of numerous studies and reports that were published last year. And one of the main issues challenging the regulators now is how to encourage competition and innovation whilst also protecting privacy and consumer choice. Whatever comes out of these proposals, we're expecting deals and commercial practices in this space to face even higher levels of scrutiny this year. It's a really rapidly changing area that all companies need to stay on top of. The second trend we're seeing is there are signs that the long-running trend of globalisation may be starting to go into reverse. We're seeing international tensions and economic protectionism having an impact on both the types of cases that regulators will pursue, but also the remedies that they might put in place to protect local consumers and businesses. Thirdly, growing pressure on companies to deliver sustainable solutions is driving them not only to invest in new green technology, but also to collaborate across industries and agree common standards which will meet these public policy objectives. As concern about climate change is obviously growing, as well as demand for real action by business, so an important question this year is when environmental objectives may trump competition concerns. So we think that we'll see technology, sustainability, and these global economic tensions play an increasingly important role in antitrust enforcement this year. They're all issues that are really high up on the agenda for regulators trying to make markets work well for consumers. But they're obviously not just issues of concern to the antitrust authorities. Other areas of the law, particularly data privacy and consumer protection, will drive decisions by regulators to take action against particular deals or behaviour which they see as causing concern.
Yes, and that's indeed why in the publication we really make a point of making this a cross-practice effort, where we bring in also the expertise of our colleagues in those various areas.
Thanks, and that's a really interesting point, and I just want to pick up on that a bit more, because I think you clearly, when we look at something like the technology space in particular, the challenge of making sure that technology markets work well for consumers is clearly a huge issue, and it is, as far as I can see, it's not an issue that the antitrust regulators are going to or should carry the burden of alone. Is that right, Sarah?
Absolutely. Just an example on data again. Any new mechanism to encourage innovation and competition in that space must also avoid breaching data privacy and consumer protection laws. So what we're seeing is regulators looking across their entire toolkits and using the tools which are most appropriate for the job. So a joined-up approach is needed, both from the regulator's perspective, but also for businesses seeking to ensure their practices remain compliant and their deals will pass ever closer regulatory scrutiny. In fact, we've seen this very recently in Europe with the new Commission President Ursula von der Leyen reappointing Margrethe Vestager to an expanded brief that covers not just competition enforcement, but also regulation of the digital economy across the EU.
You know, if we go back to tech, so Sarah, you mentioned that 2019 was a year of reports all over the world in how to deal with tech issues. So Thomas, 2020, is it going to be a year of action where we actually see more investigations and corrective measures taken, or are we in for another year of reports and hand-wringing without any real action?
There certainly has already been quite a bit of action, but I think the message to companies is be prepared for more to come. If you look at Europe, there's been a fair bit of concrete enforcement in the past few years, but certainly the European Commission and national competition authorities have flagged much more investigations to come. And they intend to use new tools or pull up older tools, like, for example, interim measures, like we've seen in the Broadcom case, and apply those much more actively. We've also, for example, heard some suggestions about changing the burden of proof and the standard of proof specifically for tech cases, which is in itself quite an interesting development. If you look in other parts of the world, take Japan, quite a lot of initiative going on there with new laws, guidelines, but also announced an enforcement in a variety of areas. Generally, I would say, clearly, there's a focus on cases involving platforms and data all around the world. We've seen that in Australia, we see that in Europe, we see that in the US. And what I would say is, if you look at it, if you unpick it a little bit into a number of areas, on the merger front, you will see, I think, enforcers trying to expand their jurisdiction to catch what they've termed killer acquisitions, whether that's in tech, but also we see that in pharma cases, for example. And I mean, that can be done either by changing the law to change your thresholds and catch more transactions, but it can also be done by changing your practice or your interpretation even of your own powers. So again, I think that's a first area where we would see quite a bit more enforcement going on, the net being cast much more widely. Secondly, I would say the business practices of any digital platforms, how data is being gathered from users, whether any types of data confer somehow a competitive advantage, are they an essential facility, how could access be given to that kind of data? That's another area where clearly we'll see a lot of enforcement or at least investigation going on. But it also goes beyond into, for example, say, distribution agreements, most favored nation clauses in the context of platforms, exclusivity provisions. The EU, for example, is reviewing its rules on how to deal with vertical arrangements, and that's going to be quite active throughout the year. And then maybe a last one to mention there, price setting algorithms. If you want sort of a tech example that goes more into the area of sort of horizontal coordination, potential collusion, definitely the role that algorithms can play, whether it be as a facilitator of an anti-competitive arrangement or potentially even an anti-competitive arrangement in its own right. That's another area where we might see some action in the year to come.
Yeah, and Thomas, that's a very interesting area because with respect to kind of traditional horizontal cartels, obviously the people involved are bad actors and typically know what they're doing is wrong. But when you're thinking about algorithms, how many companies know how their algorithms work, know how they interlink with other algorithms? So it's an area where there's potentially a lot of exposure that companies are not as aware of.
No, absolutely.
And another important impact of these rapid advances of technology, which more businesses might come across over the next year and beyond is obviously the use of technology by the regulators when they're investigating suspected anti-competitive practices and in their own compliance programmes. I think we'll come on to it in a bit, but companies need to anticipate that the regulators have really sophisticated tools in their hands now to both delve deep into their business practices and what's really going on, and businesses really need to be prepared for that by having the technology in place themselves.
It's worth saying that this isn't just a European issue. This is happening, you know, as Thomas said, all over the world. And in the US, in the middle of last year, we saw the DOJ and the FTC divide up responsibility among themselves for oversight of four of the big tech companies, Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple. They seem to be paving the way there for some big investigations to come. And in fact, we've already seen that the FTC has an investigation of Facebook pending. I now want to turn from digital to the second big topic we mentioned at the outset, which is deglobalization. Thomas, what does deglobalization mean in an antitrust context? What is the impact of deglobalization on merger review and antitrust investigations?
Jen, first of all, obviously we have seen a shift away from the longstanding narrative of globalization in international politics to begin with. And definitely when we were writing sort of our first editions of 10 key themes 10 years ago, that was definitely the mood. Things have changed quite a bit. We see trade wars, we see the WTO in difficulty. To throw out the stats, the value of Chinese investment in sensitive sectors such as automotive, energy, financials, health, and IT in the US has actually fallen by 69%. That's quite amazing, and clearly that is driven by those tendencies. What we see in an antitrust context is, in particular, a renewed focus on the impact of, say, international conglomerates or foreign investment on local markets. We see actually an overt political push for more national champions in key sectors. In Europe, there's, for example, explicit national political pressure from member states for an increased role for political and industrial priorities in national, maybe European, champions following the famous Siemens-Alstom debate. And of course, we also see foreign investment regimes proliferating at a fast pace.
That's true, Thomas. I mean, over the past few years, it seems like foreign investment regimes have just shot up on the agenda all over the world. Sarah, why have those become so much more important in the last few years?
That's right. I mean, I think there's a combination to this trend. And you know, we're really seeing governments, and I think particularly Western governments, actually really enhancing their powers to intervene in foreign investments in their countries. And as Thomas mentioned, this has developed against a backdrop of growing trade tensions and heightened political interest in cross-border deals, and particularly acquisitions of certain types of businesses. So we're seeing governments which have traditionally had a very sort of strong foreign investment regime, including in the US, take steps to strengthen that regime. And we're seeing countries in Europe introduce new regimes and very wide-ranging and far-reaching regimes which go far beyond sectors which we would traditionally think as impacting national security.
And you mentioned the US regime, where there was a major shift last year toward a mandatory regime for certain transactions, which was a big change from the voluntary regime previously. And then we also saw essentially an increase in the types of transactions that the US government is interested in. Thomas, what other jurisdictions do you think of as hotspots when you're thinking about foreign investment concerns?
Well, Jen, it's actually no longer like a defined list. It's now over 100 jurisdictions that have either some form of foreign investment rules or public interest laws. That number will only increase. We see that very much in our day-to-day practice. That's something that's very relevant for any M&A activity. You mentioned the developments in CFIUS, which are clearly very important. In the UK, we will see legislation for a standalone national security review, which has been proposed for 2020. It's likely to be voluntary, but to have a real enforcement impact. In France, in 2020, new powers will allow the Minister of the Economy to unwind, amend, or prescribe interim measures in relation to transactions that have been implemented without prior foreign investment authorization. And then there's also China, of course. It is possible that we will see an increased number of cases reviewed under China's national security regime, which until now has only been rarely used. So I would say for companies, there are a few lessons, I think, here. First of all, I would say conduct the assessment upfront. This is something that is relevant for any transaction. And what's important is be prepared, I would say, with your communication strategy to the different authorities and audiences, stakeholders involved.
Well, that's right, Thomas. I mean, one of the biggest challenges facing businesses looking forward is these reviews now capture a very wide class of transactions indeed and go very far beyond what most of us would think as assets or companies which have a real impact on national security. There's a big focus on infrastructure assets, technology and big data, particularly what they call critical infrastructure or critical technology, but without there being a really clear definition on what actually is critical. So this leads to increased uncertainty around deal planning and a need to really understand the sectors and the types of businesses which the foreign investment review bodies are likely to target and really identify that well in advance and upfront through proper and informed due diligence and transaction planning.
If we move on to the third big area that you mentioned, 10 years ago when we started this publication, the idea that we would have a webinar or a podcast for clients about climate change would not have been on anyone's radar at all. Clearly this has changed and this is one of the biggest political issues in the world today. So Thomas, is climate change affecting antitrust enforcement?
It is. Absolutely it is. And it involves trade-offs. Competition authorities will undoubtedly be pushed in the years to come to take a stance on where to strike that balance. Sustainability projects, for example, do require companies to collaborate more closely than ever before. They require suppliers and distributors to bring innovative products and services to market, to develop standards. So all of that collaboration obviously, by definition, raises questions as to where you draw the line on what is and isn't anti-competitive. So that's one side of the equation. On the other side of the equation is the question, how do you define consumer welfare or the public good, which can be used to justify collaborations? And definitely, you already see a number of authorities around the world flagging an openness to considering wider public policy goals and to simply taking an approach where you say, look, sustainability, managing impact on climate is just something that ultimately consumers expect and is a good that they value and that therefore should be taken into account in striking those balances. Is that in itself a blank check for any kind of collaboration around climate initiatives? No, it isn't. It's going to be a complex question and often without any clear legal precedent. Yes, absolutely something where we'll see quite a bit of enforcement focus for the year to come.
I mean, one example we're seeing at the moment in Europe is the Commission investigating a collaborative effort amongst car manufacturers to coordinate on the development of clean emissions technology. Does that amount to collusion? It's obviously very far beyond what we'd see as a traditional cartel. And I think we've seen similar cases being opened in the US.
Yep, that's right. So toward the end of last year, the DOJ opened an investigation into whether car manufacturers violated the antitrust law when they agreed with the state of California, actually, to lower emission standards than are required under the federal government. So, you know, we see a very kind of similar investigation in the U.S. that I think would have been quite unusual even a few years ago. But we've also heard from Megan Delrahame, who's the Assistant Attorney General at the DOJ. He's focused on coordination and collusion among implementers of technological standards and whether that can push down patent licensing rates or diminish incentives to innovate. So we are seeing investigations in this area in the US as well. Thomas, with all these new areas and investigations popping up that maybe wouldn't have been predictable a few years ago, can a company get guidance from any of the big antitrust regulators by approaching them about plans for a collaboration to see if it's okay?
Well, there's certainly an option in a number of countries around the world to get that kind of guidance. In a number of places, we have seen antitrust enforcers being quite reluctant in the past to give guidance. But I do think that given the focus on this theme, climate change generally, actually this might be the area where they choose to give guidance and really try to sort of lay it out for companies what is and isn't acceptable collaboration to advance climate goals.
I think that brings us on to a broader question of compliance more generally. And Sarah, in looking at our 2020 report, what do you think businesses can do in 2020 to minimize exposure and costs to these investigations or potential findings of infringement or private damage actions?
Well, in such a rapidly changing landscape where decisions and areas to intervene are becoming increasingly uncertain, an effective corporate compliance program is absolutely essential. But what we've seen over the last year is more authorities issue guidance on what they actually think an effective compliance program is in practice. And I'm thinking, for example, of guidance issued by the US DOJ last year, which set a particularly high standard for compliance programs and when they would consider those to be effective. We're way beyond the day where you'd have your compliance handbook on the shelf and that would be enough. These programs need to be tailored to the specific business that you're in and bespoke and readily adaptable as businesses and practices change. And there is a very strong focus on effective training of employees. So the employees must receive targeted training to their particular role and the sector that they're in, and the company must be ensuring that they understand the training and that training is being carried forward in practice.
That's right, Sarah. And in the US, one of the points the DOJ has made is that they look for compliance programs that show a real top-down commitment to compliance. And so they're not looking for a regime that looks good on paper or is a band-aid for the problem. They want to show a real cultural shift at a company before they consider a compliance regime to be, you know, worthy of credit. In the US, you know, it's long been the case that one of the benefits that you get from being compliant is potentially avoiding private litigation and the treble damages that potentially come with that. And increasingly, in the past few years, this has not just been a US point, but a European point as well. Thomas, where is private litigation heading in 2020? Still on the upswing?
Yes, we really see it as a very active area. And if I would pick one specific trend for this year, it would be collective consumer claims. In Europe, the issue to watch is whether the proposed directive on representative actions, essentially to facilitate mass claims before national courts, really goes forward. It is likely to become law in 2020. We see, meanwhile, a number of member states already on their own adopting or improving their own collective consumer claims legislation. So we definitely in Europe expect more claims to come. In the US, an issue in the context of class actions, which obviously have been around for much longer, is that of uninjured claimants in the context of those class actions and how that influences issues like class certification and so on. So this is something that we describe in a bit more detail in the publication, and I would definitely encourage you to have a read.
Great. Well, Thomas, Sarah, it sounds like 2020 clearly is going to be a testing year for businesses and politicians and regulators on the antitrust front. We'll be keeping a close eye on those developments and we'll report them to you here on the Essential Antitrust Podcast with news and insights throughout the year. So please, listeners, get in touch with me or one of your regular Freshfields contacts if there are particular topics you'd like to hear us cover, or if you'd like to learn more about any of the topics that we've covered today. Thank you again, Thomas and Sarah, for joining me, and thank you to all of you for listening. And we'll see you next time with more Essential Antitrust.